Unlike the others, who had dark eyes, this figure had neon blue eyes. He then did something she couldn't believe. He plunged his hand into my chest. Like nothing was solid, Lynette says. It hurt. I could feel pain. I first thought he had something in his hands, but I don't know if he did or not. I couldn't see. I just saw the hand going in beyond the fingers, almost to the thumb. He had three fingers, and they were webbed, from the palm to the first digit. And I hurt, and I almost felt like I was burning. Your heart is physically and spiritually healed, the being said. It is to our benefit to keep you well. He then told her that she must stop eating meat, that eating meat is like consuming your own flesh, that it was because of her diet that they had to heal her heart. You must tell people to stop eating animals, he said. You must tell people that you are all interconnected. The power of intention is real. Thought is real. If you don't stop putting out the greed and negativity you are putting out, you are going to kill your race. Lynette was stunned by the message, but the being was insistent. The power of intention is real, he repeated. Thought is reality. You must pay attention because you are going to do what we did. He was concerned that we're going to self-destruct like they did, Lynette says, that we're going to become nothing like they did. They chose to become higher beings, and in doing so, they bred out their emotions and lost the ability to reproduce. At some point, the same being took her to a room filled with giant bell jars with babies growing in them. Lynette saw that the beings appeared to be half human, half gray. They were hybrids. These are yours, the being told her. We can't breed anymore. He was telling me that they don't have emotions, it's been bred out of them, but they're trying to breed them in. The being then gave her a series of prophecies or predictions. He warned Lynette that Buffalo, New York would experience a devastating explosion, that there was a huge earthquake fault in Missouri leading south through the center of the United States, and that there would soon be a series of hurricanes that would make Hurricane Katrina look small in comparison. He said that they had warned her about 911, and were giving her these predictions because of what she had given to them. It's a gift to replace what we've taken, the being said. The being said that there were going to be more sightings and that if people should start disappearing from the planet, it was because of them and was being done for the universal good. The being told Lynette that throughout human history, their visits have been recorded as angelic visitations. We are who the angels are, the being said. We are who you have thought were angels. The being said that many cultures have worshipped them as gods, that they've been coming here to Earth for many thousands of years. They said that they have manipulated the genetics of both humans and animals. They claim to have specifically boosted the emotional intelligence of dogs and cats in an effort to improve their ability to associate with humans. Can you please stop taking me? Lynette asked. No, your eggs are still good. We cannot stop until we are finished, the being said. I am a part of you, he said. I am a part of you. I'm here to protect you. I will always protect you. Lynette suddenly realized who the being was. He was from her first missing pregnancy. He was her son. You must remember this, the being told her. He explained that they want her to tell people about them, and about her experiences. They want me to tell people, Lynette says, and that's just so bizarre because it's always been such a thing to be quiet, be quiet. At some point, the experience ended. She's not sure if she remembers it all, as her next memory is of waking up the next morning. More experiences would follow. On one occasion, she was pulled on board a craft and was being examined when she heard her son, Lee, then aged 14, screaming, "Mama, help! Mama! What are you doing to him?" Lynette asked. "You don't need to worry about it," they said. "He'll be okay." On another occasion, she was taken on board and guided to a room. They put a navy blue shiny covering on her body. It clung to her skin so tightly, it appeared to become a part of her. "You have to do something," the being said. "What do I need to do?" Lynette asked. "You have to hold this child," they said, handing her a hybrid baby. "I didn't want to," says Lynette, but she did. "It's like I don't own my own body anymore." The baby was ugly, she thought, and its human gray appearance scared her badly. Despite the healing, the physical and emotional trauma she has already experienced at the hands of the Grey ETs, and the fact that her children have become involved, have left her with a negative impression of her encounters. She has obeyed the ET's edict to stop eating meat and is currently a vegetarian. Although she is now in her 60s, her experiences continue to occur. She just wants them to finally end. She feels almost as though the ETs think of her as we think of farm animals. "I want them to stop," she says. "I'm afraid to sleep at night. When it happens, I'm so exhausted. I wake up at 3:21 a.m., and there they are." She doesn't believe the ETs are evil, but often the Greys seem to act with little compassion. "That's how it feels," says Lynette. "They're just doing their jobs." Lynette has no answers about why she's being contacted. "I don't know why they talk to me," she says. "They're really frustrated with us, because we're just not getting it." Chapter 6, Where is Paul? In 1978, Tony T. was a young man in college. He and a group of a half dozen friends often spent weekends up in the deserts outside of Palm Springs, California, where one of them had access to a remote cabin. On this particular evening, they were all at the cabin when one of the friends, Paul, decided to take a late evening walk by himself. Several hours passed, Paul had not returned, and Tony and the others were becoming worried. It wasn't like him to just disappear. They were getting ready to go out and look for him when he suddenly returned. "Where were you?" they all asked. "We were about to go search for you. I saw something land over in the hills over there," said Paul, "so I went walking over to check it out. It was a UFO." Paul's friends looked at him in shock. "Wow," one of them said. "You're bullshitting us. I don't believe in that stuff." They laughed and told him to shut up. Everyone seemed to be skeptical. Tony, however, believed in UFOs. He knew that Paul wasn't the kind of guy who joked about things, and he was interested in what Paul had to say. He began asking him questions. "What did you see?" he asked. "What did it look like?" Everyone turned and listened. "Well, it was this saucer kind of shape," Paul said. "There were people. These aliens. They looked kind of like us." Paul gave a long description of the figures, which Tony now recognizes as the typical Greys, or perhaps Grey-human hybrids. They were short, about 5 feet, with greyish skin. They had large dark eyes, bald heads, and wore white uniforms. "They were walking around the outside of their ship," Paul said, "so I went down to see what was up." "Really?" asked Tony. "Did you talk to them?" "Yeah," said Paul. "I went in their ship and looked around in it." "Wow," Tony replied. "What happened?" "Well, I talked to them. They're going to be back here." Paul said that the aliens were going to return on a certain day, about 2 years from now. Their traveling schedule, they told him, would bring them to this exact area. "Yeah?" one of the friends asked. "So, why?" "Well," said Paul, "because they wanted to know if I wanted to go with them, and they're going to take me with them." "No. No way," Tony and the others chorused. "Seriously," Paul protested. "They said if I want to come, be here at this day 1 year from now, at the same spot." Most everyone shook their heads and said, "Yeah, yeah, you're full of it. You're crazy. You're full of shit." Tony, however, believed Paul and asked him, "What are you going to do?" "I don't know," said Paul. "I'm going to think about it." "You should have come back and got me," said Tony. "That would have been cool. We could have at least gotten them to give us a ride around a little bit and come back." Tony was impressed by Paul's story and was eager to see what his decision would be. "He didn't have to wait long," says Tony. "Over the year, coming up to that time, he started getting rid of all his stuff. He gave all his stuff away. Everybody started getting a little worried, and his family thought that maybe he was going through a mental breakdown or something, because he was just getting rid of all his possessions. He said, 'I don't need this anymore. I don't need them.'" Tony spoke with him several times. "Are you thinking of going with these guys?"
"I'm going out there," Paul said. "I don't know. I'm going to go back there. I don't know if I'm going to go with them. I don't know."
"Well,
make sure everybody knows where you're going. There wasn't really much else to say. At this point, Tony didn't really believe Paul would actually leave. The whole story seemed crazy. But Paul appeared to be seriously considering going out there. And sure enough, when the day arrived, it happened. Paul drove off alone into the desert to meet with the aliens. Says Tony, he went out to the desert, to that place, the day that they were supposed to be there. We didn't hear anything after a couple of days. His parents were worried. They called us and asked us. We said that we knew pretty much where he was going. So, we all go out there. And we found his car, out there, out in the middle of nowhere, just parked, out in the desert there. Some of the people thought that maybe he might have committed suicide. His car was there, his car keys. He was never seen again. We never saw him or heard a thing from him. From that day he was gone. He disappeared. He was 22 years old. After finding Paul's car abandoned with the car keys in it, Paul's parents filed a missing persons report. The police questioned them extensively and then began to question Paul's friends, including Tony. Each of them told them what happened that evening, that Paul claimed to have come upon a landed craft, and that they had invited him to come along. "This is all I can tell you," Tony told the police. "This is what he told us happened out here." The police had no choice but to believe the witnesses. Paul was never seen again. To this day, Tony wonders if his friend Paul is still alive, living his life somewhere out there on board a UFO. Chapter 7, The Flying Saucer and the Atlantean Bracelet. In the early 1980s, James Santiago was a very successful and famous nightclub performer, though to avoid the politics of celebrity and for other reasons, he performed under a pseudonym. His career, of course, necessitated a lot of traveling. And if there was one thing James hated, it was long car drives. Therefore, pretty much without exception, he always traveled by plane. In 1982, his busy schedule took him to Calgary, Alberta, Canada, where he did a month-long series of performances. His next gig was a few hundred miles away in Vancouver. He was, of course, going to fly, but then he met Cleo Jensen, pseudonym. Cleo Jensen was a world-famous artist with numerous paintings hanging in museums and other institutions around the world. Her daughter, Melanie, pseudonym, was a makeup artist and worked closely with James in his shows. Melanie and James soon became very good friends. Melanie mentioned several times that her mother was a famous painter, but James didn't pay much attention until he actually saw the paintings. An accomplished artist himself, James instantly recognized the master quality of Cleo's work. Melanie smiled and told him that her mother was coming to visit, and that she would introduce her. "She's very eccentric," she warned him. "With my mom, all this wild stuff happens." James smiled, and told her that anybody who could paint like this couldn't be that bad. However, James was shocked when he actually met her. Eccentric was a bit of an understatement. "She was the strangest woman I have ever met," James says. "Melanie tried to prepare me beforehand, but there's no preparing you for that." Cleo was a heavy woman in her mid-50s. She had extremely pale white skin and long white hair which she tied partly up in a Mae West knot and left the rest hanging. She dressed in all black and wore no makeup except for black eyeliner on her lids and around the entire eyes. She was a strict vegetarian and a germaphobe. She was extremely wealthy, highly intelligent, psychic, outspoken, opinionated, didn't like most people, and for some reason, James found himself intrigued with her. For whatever reason, they just hit it off. Says James, "She loved me. She thought I was the greatest thing since sliced bread." She had 100 other idiosyncrasies, but James didn't care. One morning over breakfast, James, Melanie, Cleo and several others were at the same table when Cleo began staring oddly at James. James wondered if something was wrong when Cleo finally said, "Let me see your hands." James held his hands open. She grabbed his wrists and glanced at his palms. "Oh, you have the mystic M's on your palms," she said, and then launched into a spiel about psychic abilities, karma and other spiritual subjects. Much of it went over James's head. At the time, He had virtually no exposure to occult subjects. He came from a well-to-do Spanish family and was raised as a strict Catholic. But as he says, the Catholic stuff didn't stick. At an early age, his mother died and he had a dramatic encounter with her ghost. The experience convinced him of life after death. However, that was pretty much the limit of his experience with anything paranormal. Cleo, he thought, was different from anybody he had ever met. As she finished talking about James, she said, "I have to go to Vancouver. You should come with me and cancel your flight." James's first thought was, "Are you on drugs?" But instead of vocalizing it, he just said, "No, not in a million years," and explained his aversion to long car rides. Cleo, however, was also very stubborn, and she continued to urge James to cancel his flight and just take the car ride with her. She would do all the driving. They could stay in a hotel and be there in 2 days, plenty of time before his booking. Still James said no. Cleo, of course, continued to insist, and then Melanie got into the act, telling James, "You should go with my mum." Melanie explained that she would go herself, but she had prior engagements in Calgary, and she would fly into Vancouver in time for the show. Melanie explained that her mother was wealthy enough to afford whatever she wants, but owned little except for her car, which she basically lived out of, staying in hotels for only a few days at a time, and traveling around the country. The car was Cleo's only real possession. Says James, "She was a very strange woman, really strange, a very peculiar person, so I'm definitely not driving with her. But she worked on me for a week and a half. I cannot tell you to this day why I agreed to do it, but I finally said okay. I caved under the pressure, and I did it." When James saw her car, he got another clue of how unusual Cleo was. It was a shiny, midnight blue, customized Monte Carlo, with a spotlessly clean, white leather interior. At the time, he didn't realize how special the car was. "I was to find out more about that car as the trip progressed," James says. As he got in and they drove off, he said to himself, "Oh, my God, you moron. What are you doing?" But it was too late. He was now committed. By now James was used to Cleo's frequent strange requests, but still, her next question surprised him. They were only 20 miles out when she asked, "Do you have any pennies on you?" James looked at her with a puzzled expression. "Ah, yeah, I have pennies. Do you have a lot? Do you have a lot of change?" "Well, yes, I have a box of change in my luggage, yes." "Would you mind," she asked politely, taking out all the pennies and the quarters that are sandwiched with copper. "The pennies and the quarters?" She nodded. "Okay, no, I don't mind. Why?" She was silent for a moment, and then said, "I think you should know I'm being followed by UFOs." James looked at her in shock. His first thought was, "Oh, God. Here I am in the middle of nowhere in Canada with this crazy woman who's being followed by UFOs, and she wants to know if I have any copper." Cleo then explained that the UFO people were somehow able to receive her or track her with the copper, that it helped them to follow her and she absolutely would not have any copper in the car. She told him that she had every bit of copper in the car taken out and replaced with pure silver. "I don't know how many $100,000 she paid for this car," James says, "because it was like a James Bond car. It had all this weird stuff in it, but it looked like a normal car." At this point, they were driving through a small town. James said, "Okay, it's in the back. Pull over here and let's open the back." Cleo pulled over and James fished out his box of change. A young kid was walking by and James motioned to him, "Kid, come here." The young boy walked over cautiously. James himself was making good money, and was not about to waste his time separating the various coins. Instead he handed the box to the kid and said, "Here, this is your lucky day." They got back into the car and drove off. After a few minutes, Cleo said, "You don't believe me, do you?" James looked at her and shrugged. "I don't know. I'm telling the truth," she insisted, and explained that she had been followed by UFOs her entire life. She started to tell him more, but it became apparent that James wasn't really interested. However, Cleo was more stubborn than James and she approached him from a different angle. It turned out that Cleo was also extremely intelligent and contained a wealth of knowledge about various occult subjects. She spoke about the ancient Egyptians and then began educating him about Atlantis. She told him Atlantis was real, and that it was a very advanced civilization, and that many of the children of Atlantis have reincarnated today with the hopes of rectifying the world's present volatile situation. James was entranced by her stories, and amazed by her beliefs and obviously extensive knowledge. He shared the story of his encounter with his mother's ghost, and she reassured him that it was a real experience and that there is, in fact, an invisible spiritual world round us. They spent the next 6 hours driving and talking about various esoteric subjects. Says James, "It was just the best day. We were bonding like crazy and I was feeling so good. I never thought that in a million years I would bond with this woman, but she's like the coolest woman. I totally didn't understand. She's a great teacher, and we were really enjoying each other's company." Around dusk, they pulled over at one of the last gas food stops before they had to cross the Rockies. Cleo said, "Well, we should get something to eat because it's going to be a while before we get to the other side." James agreed. They went inside the little diner and ordered a meal. As they ate, they couldn't help but notice that the two men at the table next to them were staring. Says James, "They sat and they just stared at us the whole time, not once took their eyes off of us. It was weird." They ate their meal and continued their journey. The road now started to rise into the heart of the Canadian Rockies, twisting and winding as it snaked through the steep mountain passes. James again began to feel some trepidation about embarking on the journey, and he hoped that Cleo was a good driver. It was around 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock. They had both been quiet, marveling at the rugged landscape. Suddenly Cleo turned to James and asked him, "Do you feel the pressure?" "Pressure?" James wondered. "What pressure?" "No, I don't," he answered, wondering what Cleo was up to this time. "Well, you will," she said flatly. "We're about to see a UFO." James gave her another perplexed look. A UFO? Was she kidding? Not knowing how to respond to such a bizarre declaration, he remained silent. Seeing that James was skeptical, Cleo also said nothing. Then, a few minutes later, he felt it. Says James, "We're driving along and all of a sudden I feel this pressure. It was like somebody pushing, not in a painful way, but there was definite pushing on my head and on my shoulders, and just pushing my body into the seat. It was a palpable pressure. My whole body was just pushed into the seat. I was surprised, of course. It didn't hurt at all. It was just surprising and disconcerting. I had never experienced anything like that." "Holy shit!" James exclaimed. "I can feel it." Cleo looked at him and smiled. Although she said no words, her "I told you so" expression said enough. James didn't have time to ask her about the pressure when suddenly an enormous saucer-shaped object appeared above the car. There were no individual lights, portals or markings on the object. Instead, the entire object glowed an exquisitely beautiful turquoise green color. The illumination lit up the entire interior of the car and a circle of the road around them. The object took a position about 40 feet above the car and maintained it with absolute precision. It was completely silent. Cleo let out a small yell and, apparently unhappy to see the UFO, pressed the accelerator to the floor. James, on the other hand, was thrilled to see the object. In fact, the mere presence of the UFO seemed to be affecting his consciousness in a way that he found hard to describe. Says James, "I was so excited. I've never been that awake in my life. I was so in the moment, and I remember it so vividly. I was not the least bit afraid. I was totally enthusiastic and excited and hoping they would land and I would go up and knock knock knock." Cleo looked up at the UFO and then gave James another "I told you so" expression. "See? I told you," she said. "I apologize," James said. "How could I have known? The world doesn't even know. Now I know. I'm sorry." Cleo smiled dryly as she turned her attention back to the road. The car screeched as it tore around the steep curves. James looked at the railings alongside the road. Suddenly they seemed thin as toothpicks, and he wished that Clea would slow down. At the same time, however, his attention was riveted to the object above them. It was perfectly silent and maneuvered with incredible agility, as if it had a governor that locked to their car. To his amazement, it continued to follow them into the mountains. Says James, it stayed with the car for a really long time, I mean, like 10 minutes, and that's an eternity in that heightened state. It was long enough that I started relaxing with it. I was really getting into it. It was so beautiful. The turquoise glow of it. It was really pretty. Everything James looked at seemed to take on deep meaning. The way the turquoise light lit up the white upholstery. The whiteness of the doors, the way Cleo's leg stiffened to press the gas pedal, everything seemed so vivid and almost surreal. As he stared at the object, he told himself, remember this forever and all time. Burn this into your memory, because you're going to tell people about this and they're not going to believe you. As the time passed, James noticed that the weird pressure on their bodies was increasing. After the first 10 minutes, the pressure began to feel very strange, and James felt his first glimmerings of fear. As he says, it was starting to get uncomfortable. It just felt really weird. It not only felt like you were being pushed into the seat, your ears felt like when you dive into the bottom of a swimming pool. It was pressurized, kind of like that. Despite the increasing pressure, James was still ready to get out of the car and jump on board the UFO. Cleo evidently felt the pressure get stronger too, because she turned to James and said, open the glove box and take everything out. James looked at her and, shaking his head with puzzlement, obeyed her strange request and emptied the contents of the glove box onto the floor. Now reach your hand in, said Cleo, and you'll feel a button. Push the button and a door will open. Reach in and take out the contents and put it between us. James looked at her with disbelief and astonishment and began to wonder again what he was doing with this crazy woman. However, Cleo was adamant, so he reached into the glove compartment and felt around for a button. He was armpit deep before he found it hidden at the bottom. He pressed it and a latch flipped open, snapping painfully against his fingers. He pulled his hand out in alarm, then, seeing Cleo's stern expression, reached back into the glove box and found the secret chamber. Says James, I could feel something heavy wrapped in cloth. I picked it up and I pulled it out. The object was wrapped in a velvety purple material. Unwrap it, Cleo said, and put it between us. James quickly pulled away the folds of cloth and tossed it aside. His eyes widened with amazement as he realized what the object was. Says James, it was this magnificent bracelet, but it was very large and very heavy. It would have to be for a man, because it would just knock a woman over, and it would fall off a woman's wrist. Because it was big and thick, and it weighed a lot. It was solid gold, with all this filigree work that was just magnificent. And then there were 6 or 7 of these big, oval, faceted stones that were sort of a sea foam green set around it. The workmanship of it was staggering. I mean, it was like for a king. It was just so beautiful with the stones and the way they were glimmering in the light with that thing over us. James felt himself reaching a strange state of sensory overload. The UFO was exerting a tangible pressure on them and was easily the strangest and the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. However, now that Cleo had revealed this incredible and clearly priceless piece of art, James felt his attention torn between the UFO and the solid gold bracelet, which also seemed to almost radiate with power. Put it between us, Cleo repeated. James did, and she slipped her right hand into it and motioned for James to do the same, which he did. Now rub it, Cleo ordered. James didn't bother to ask why. The strangeness of his predicament was overwhelming, so he simply obeyed and began rubbing the bracelet along with Cleo. Whatever alleged power the bracelet had, it seemed to work. Says James, within 4 or 5 seconds, the pressure started to lift. Then the craft went up and it was gone. Cleo finally slowed down the car and James peered upward through the windshield. The craft was definitely gone. They continued rubbing the strange bracelet for a few more minutes until Cleo finally said that they could stop. She motioned for him to wrap it back up and place it back in the secret compartment. Okay, said James, and held up the bracelet for a quick last examination. He had never seen anything remotely like it. "What is this?" he asked her. "Well," she hesitated.